Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And we are also pleased to have this morning as our guest, Peter Lefcourt. He is a novelist. He has authored seven, I think, if you count the new one. He is also an award-winning writer for film and television and makes his home in Los Angeles. His new book is titled The Manhattan Beach Project, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. And we will, in presently here, we'll tell you a little bit about the book and about the character that he created. Questions, of course, as we move along here through the hour are welcome. Number to call if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Now, that's the number to call into the show. A pledge is not required. It would be nice because we are raising money for the station this week, but that's a completely separate deal, separate number. So here, you want to call on the show, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Peter Lefcourt, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
I'm delighted to be on the show.
We certainly appreciate it. Well, let's just plunge right in and talk a little bit about the Manhattan Beach Project. Your lead character here is a fellow who managed to win himself an Academy Award for producing a movie. But at the time that we meet him, when the story opens, he's kind of on the skids. He's living in his nephew's pool house. He's driving a borrowed car, and he's attending a meeting of Debtors Anonymous. Tell us about Charlie Burns.
Charlie Burns was the hero of my first novel called The Deal, which is a kind of dark comedy about the movie business. And it struck me, at the end of that book, Charlie wins an Academy Award for very improbable reasons. And it struck me fittingly that in a couple of years after winning an Academy Award, you could very, very possibly in this business be on the bottom. And so we rediscover Charlie, once more unemployable, unable to get a job, living, as you say, in his nephew's pool house and going to Debtors Anonymous, trying to figure out how to deal with the mountains of debt that are surrounding him. He's kind of a typical character in this town because people in Hollywood go up and down with great rapidity. You could be the king of the world one day and you could be bum the next. And so I had a kind of fondness for Charlie and didn't want to leave him stranded 6 books ago, and I decided to bring him back. And in this book, of course, he gets involved in the somewhat surreal world of reality television.
That happens when he's approached by someone and who identifies himself as a operative in the CIA, says, I have a lot of experience and contacts in Central Asia, and I have this idea for this reality program. And he says to Charlie, he says, well, you know about show business. You know about television and about movies. So I need someone to produce this for me. I have the contacts. I have the idea. You can produce it for me. And the idea is a reality television show set in Uzbekistan that focuses on a warlord.
I think the log line, as we say in this business, is Tony Soprano meets Genghis Khan.
Is that like what they call high concept? You can describe it, if you can describe it in one sentence, you've got something?
Exactly. The setup is that, first of all, the title, The Manhattan Beach Project, is a play, obviously, on the Manhattan Project, which was the top secret government research and development project for the atomic bomb during World War II. It struck me that the television business nowadays is so desperate that these networks are almost on a warlike footing with one another, that it was perfectly feasible that they have a sort of secret weapon development factory. And so I predicate that there's a division of ABC called ABCD, which is located in Manhattan Beach, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. And in secret, they have these bunch of people sitting around developing extreme reality television shows, the types of high-concept, slightly dangerous shows that the network cannot associate themselves too publicly with. One of the projects, for example, they have under development in this Skunk Works is called Kidnapped, where they actually kidnap an unsuspecting person, bring him to a secret location, film that, and then call up his friends and relatives and see how much ransom they would offer. Anyway, Charlie goes with this man, Kermit Fenster, and pitches a reality television concept called Warlord, which essentially is a documentary-style program on the life of a Uzbek warlord named Izbel Karkov. And, of course, they buy it, and they develop it in secret.
What's troubling in a way when you think to yourself, okay, I'm going to make up, I'm going to develop a premise for a reality show, and I'm going to do what I think is the most absurd thing that I can possibly think of, like the two examples that you cite. What frightens me is the idea that a writer would come up with something that you think, well, this is completely beyond the pale, and but the next time you turn the television on, you'll see it. It seems that there's nothing that they almost nothing that they won't do.
I believe absolutely. That's why this Secret Skunk Works is absolutely experimenting with some of the most outrageous things. It's not beyond the pale of possibility that a network would do this type of thing. In fact, some of my friends have jokingly said I should have pitched the reality show instead of written a novel. This is a work of fiction, but it's obviously based in reality. I think there is a great deal of desperation in the television business these days about trying to find hits, trying to find things that people will watch. And I see no reason why they wouldn't try this. I think it was Paddy Chayefsky who said in Network about 20 years ago or 30 years ago that they would televise The Crucifixion if it got ratings. And so anyway, Charlie develops this program, goes to Uzbekistan with Kermit Fenster, who is the name of the ex-CIA agent, finds a warlord and begins to photograph his life and runs into some interesting adventures. He finds out, by the way, that the warlord's life is not that interesting. And so what he does, along with he finds this ex-Peace Corps volunteer who is working in Uzbekistan building septic tanks named Buzz Bowden, and Buzz and he decide that since nobody understands Uzbek anyway, they rewrite the subtitles and create a kind of fictional reality show, which hits all the bases because not only do we have the real violence and the real life, but we have some interesting kind of soap opera situations.
Hmm. Well, that also tells you something about the reality show, because in fact, the reality show is not reality, and that the people who produce it do all sorts of things, manipulate situations, who knows what kind of editing goes on, to make a show that they think is going to be interesting, is going to have drama. So, in fact, saying that it's a reality program is something of a misnomer.
Absolutely. By all means, the act of editing becomes, in fact, an act of creating, an act of writing a story. In the Manhattan Beach Project, our warlord, who is married to a sullen woman who doesn't ever leave her room, he has in real life a fundamentalist Muslim son who wants to join the Taliban, and he has a gay daughter. And what our writers, quote-unquote, do is they decide that the American audience would never really accept a son who ran off to join the Taliban. So in the fictional translation of the subtitles, he runs off to go to law school in Tashkent. And the wife, who is notoriously absent from the warlord's compound, is actually getting a facelift in Azerbaijan. And so they really create a soap opera out of the reality of the warlord's life.
Our guest on this part of Focus 580 is Peter Lefcourt. He is a novelist. He's also written for film and television. Among his credits are Cagney and Lacey, a program for which he won an Emmy Award. He's the author of a number of novels, including 11 Karens, The Dreyfus Affair, The Deal, The Woody, Die and I, and Abbreviating Ernie. He is also the editor of an anthology of pieces that were written by screenwriters writing about their first jobs. He has a piece in there, and there are a number of others. And that book is titled The First Time I Got Paid for It. His new novel is The Manhattan Beach Project, and it is out now, and it is published by Simon & Schuster. And questions, comments certainly are welcome. If you want to call and talk with our guest, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. This must be, I would imagine that writers, people who have written for television or want to write for television, they must hate the reality show because, I'm not exactly sure that it excludes writers because, as we've said, you know, it's not a documentary. But at the same time, you really don't need people to write stories. I guess I think you don't really need people to write the stories. So writers must hate these shows because it means, you know, those guys, we don't need those guys anymore.
I think hate is too mild a word. I'm also a member of the board of directors of the Writers Guild here in Los Angeles, and reality television is replacing and displacing a lot of writers from employment. unemployment. It's causing an economic problem among not just writers, but also among directors and actors in Hollywood, because reality shows are done entirely by non-union talent. Of course, the question is, as you so rightly say, aren't these shows really written? And in fact, they are. The so-called producers who sit in the editing room and edit the footage actually create stories after the fact. Also, the producers who think up the concepts of these shows are, in fact, doing writing functions. So we believe that these shows should be, in fact, credited, writers should be credited, and they should be union shows using Writers Guild talent. They don't. They exploit their labor. People work very long hours for very little money. So it's become a political hot potato here in Hollywood. Mm.
Well, when you wrote the first book and you created this hero, your main character, Charlie Burns, who also reappears here in Manhattan Beach Project, surely you must have drawn some on your own experiences. Was this one of those cases where you thought that you'd been kicked around and you said to yourself, okay, I'm going to bust this down wide open, I'm going to write this book, and I'm going to tell it like it really is, and people are going to see what it's really like, and my fellow writers will hoist me upon their shoulders and carry me around town? Was there just even the tiniest little bit in the back of your head somewhere thinking, "Yeah, I'm gonna put the truth on the page, and that's what people are gonna get"?
Well, interestingly enough, when I wrote the deal, which I wrote the deal in 1989, I had actually won an Emmy about 3 years previously to that for Cagney and Lacey. Hmm. And by that point, 3 years after winning an Emmy, I couldn't get a job, because I had, I guess, antagonized the wrong people. And it seemed to me perfectly fitting that in this town, as I said, 3 years after winning a major award, nobody will hire you. And so I set out to write a book because I wanted to, it's essentially, as people said, bite the hand that fed me. And so I wrote The Deal, which is a very dark satire about the movie business. And the book came out and it became a cult favorite. And perversely, I became very employable again. For some reason, in that masochistic logic of Hollywood, people suddenly wanted to give me work. So I wound up working as a screen and television writer a lot in the 90s while I was writing novels. So go figure.
That does bring you the question about, or raise the question in my mind at least, about the value of these awards to the people who get them, and how it is that you, as you say, could have won a major award in television and then not been able to get work, or your character here in the book wins an Academy Award and then, as they say, can't get arrested. You wonder, well, what exactly is the value of this award? You get to take it home. You get your moment there where you get to stand up and say, I'd like to thank everybody for this. And you take it home and you put it on your mantelpiece. And I'm sure that that people come over and they look at it and they're envious. But then how quickly does the shine wear off? And does it get to a point where it's almost like you hadn't won it in the first place?
Well, I use mine as a doorstop. It's very effective. It's a large Emmy statue. Nothing is so fleeting as success in the entertainment business. There are people who have won Louise Fletcher won an Academy Award, a marvelous actress, and 2 or 3 years later she was doing small roles on television movies. It really goes with the territory, and this is very much of a youth-oriented business. Once you get past 30, 40, or God forbid, 50, you're basically put out to pasture. There's an enormous amount of ageism in this business. And those of us who've been around for a while kind of accept it. It's really very much of a kind of free-falling economy. Someone said that the pole is greased with which you go up and down. And it certainly happened to me in my career, and it's happened to a lot of people I know. Fortunately, I've had my books, which have always provided me with, a sense of creative satisfaction, because it's difficult to, even under the best of circumstances, it's difficult to be a writer in Hollywood. Because movies and television shows are really not about writing. They're about movie stars and they're about camera work. And a writer is just really one element, though the most important element in the process. The writer is often denigrated. You could ask your audience, for example, to name a prominent screenwriter today. And I bet very few will come up with the name of someone who's not a writer-director. They'll think of Quentin Tarantino because he's a writer-director. But in terms of a pure writer, we have a little joke here we call the Tomb of the Unknown Writer. And it's always been that way in the business of screenwriting.
It's really, it's tough, and maybe the only revenge writers get is they manage to write things where they can make the writers the hero, or can point out the fact just how little control writers have, or how you may write something, and the studio might even say, oh, this is great, we're going to do this, but then it ends up being given to somebody else who ends up doing something to it, and then it may go to somebody else who does something with it. And by the time that it comes, it even becomes a finished script, much less a movie, you might look at it and say, I didn't write this. You wouldn't even recognize it.
Right. We have to paraphrase F. Scott Fitzgerald, the best writing well is the best revenge. There was a T-shirt that people were wearing around Hollywood recently that said, I didn't write the Flintstones, because there were 35 credited writers on the Flintstones. It really goes with the territory. Writing and rewriting, you write a script, and the studio executive needs to have at least 10 people rewrite that until it's right, and then a director is brought in, and he or she has a writer that goes through the script, and then the star is hired, and that person has a writer. And, you know, that's why I write books, because at least when you write books, it's your book, and nobody can rewrite you. You can't get fired off your own book.
How many scripts are written and are paid for, so writers were paid for their work, that never go anywhere?
Well, I can reverse the question and tell you that I think, I would say perhaps one of 20 scripts that are purchased actually make it to film, and it may even be larger than that. So, I mean, that's good for writers. It creates employment, but it's also frustrating. There's something we call development hell, in which you finish a script, you do all the rewrites, and then it flounders around for a year or two while they look for the right movie star to star in it, or the right director to direct it, or the right climate or location to shoot it. And listen, this has been going on since the days of Nathaniel West and F. Scott Fitzgerald and William Faulkner, who also wrote screenplays in Hollywood. And I'm not at all bitter. I accept it. It's part of the system. And, you know, when I want to write, I write books. And you know, several of my books have been optioned for movies. The one that is probably the best known is a book called The Dreyfus Affair, which was my second novel after The Deal. And it's a book about two baseball players who fall in love and cause a scandal. And it's really a comedy about how baseball deals with the public relations aspect of two baseball players falling in love. And that book has been optioned 5 times for movies and has never been made. It got fairly close a couple of years ago with Ben Affleck playing one of the stars, but and Betty Thomas directing. But that deal dissolved when Ben decided he wanted to go do Pearl Harbor in Hawaii for a lot more money. So that movie still hasn't been made.
Oh, yeah, and we know what a big success Pearl Harbor was.
Yes.
Yeah, great decision there, Ben.
Absolutely. Well, go figure. At the moment, 11 Karens is under option. That's going to be a challenging screenplay because it's about 11 women named Karen, all of whom the narrator has had some connection with. But I'm writing a script about that. And The Woody, which is the novel before that, is also under option.
Mm-hmm.
So we are hopeful that sometime in my lifetime or my children's lifetime, there will be a movie. But you know something, David, even if there isn't, the fact that the book exists and the fact that I get letters on my website from readers is enough to make me happy as a writer.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take just a brief pause here, Peter, because we're here at the tail end of a week where we've been going here in front of the microphones and begging people for money. So we're going to do that for a moment here, and then we're going to talk some more with our guest, Peter.
Okay, people
Lefkoe.
Give money to the station.
That's right. People give money to this. Yeah, not to me personally. That would be nice. They could write out a check to me. But no, that's really not the idea. The idea is that people are giving money to the station. It's public radio and public TV, and that really means that the public's got to support it, or else we're not going to be able to do what we do.
Go for it.
All right. Well, we'll put you on hold here for just a sec. We'll give the phone number here. My good friend Jack Brighton,
hello,
who was producer for this program for a long time and now continues to be a guest host, and now his other job, his thing he spends most of his time on, is working on our web, various kinds of web-based services, things like the archive we have of past interviews, the fact that we're now streaming on the web so you can listen that way, the fact that also we actually, our archive is now downloadable.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
right,
a lot of things like that, and just trying to improve and make our website more usable, more useful, better to look at, all those kind of things that he really has been involved in the last couple of years.
Right. Well, before I reflect on that, let's give the phone number for people to call. So if they've been waiting, please make your pledge call right now, 244-9455. This is the last weekday of our drive and the last chance for folks who are fans of Focus 580 and David Inge to support the station, so we hope you will do that. I sure enjoy doing the web development stuff here, but I really miss producing Focus 582, I got to tell you, David. And David is just great to work with. I mean, we have a great crew here. But I was listening to this interview and just drawn into it because I love hearing writers talk about writing and about, you know, the life of a writer and the work that they're doing and so forth. And this is the kind of show where we can do that. It's really a very unusual thing anymore in the media that you have an opportunity to hear these writers, great artists who are talking about their work. You know, we're not talking about Michael Jackson, and we're not talking about, you know, whatever other scandal has sort of gripped the rest of the mainstream media. We're talking about ideas and really sort of thoughtful conversations about the work people do as creative human beings. So that's my pitch. I hope that it's something, if you're listening to the station, I assume that you enjoy. We need you to support that to keep doing it. That's what this is all about. 217-244-9455 is our pledge number. And, you know, speaking of the website, you can go there and make a pledge as well, will.uiuc.edu. We accept your credit card pledge right there on the site, and that's easy enough to do, so hope you will do that. Can we check in real quick with David Thiel?
Yeah, let's do that.
Today, David Thiel is our TV program director, and he's volunteered to stand by the telephones and talk to us about how things are going.
And I'm literally standing by the telephones right now. and frankly, I'd love to be able to sit down, but I can't do that right now. We have several lines engaged at the moment, but I believe that the volunteers are taking calls for our FM station, not the AM station. So AM listeners, right now, we want to hear from you at 244-9455 on this last morning of Focused 580 during this winter pledge drive. It's very important that we hear from you. And, you know, I've hosted this show a few times,
right,
as a guest host, and mm-hmm. and I don't know if people appreciate the amount of work that goes into this. Not to toot my own horn, but I mean, I'm saying on behalf of David and the other people who have hosted the show from time to time. I mean, there's a lot of work that goes into doing one of these interviews, because we actually read the book, for starters.
Right.
Unlike a lot of interview shows, we read the book and actually have to, you know, sit down and really prepare a lot of questions and think of things that hopefully will be interesting to say before the interview even starts.
Yeah.
You know, we don't just jump into it.
And that proves we're crazy, actually, because nobody else is doing that out there. I mean, authors comment today. I hear it all the time on David Inge's interviews. The author goes, "You actually read my book."
Yeah, I remember, you know, we had a couple of years back, I had the Trading Spaces people in here, and, you know, and I was giving all kinds of little anecdotes about, you know, their careers outside the show, and they said, You did your research. And I was like, yeah, well, that's what we do. So, you know, we hope that the listeners appreciate that effort and appreciate the work that goes into these programs. This is not something you're going to find everywhere else. And we hope that they'll call right now at 244-9455.
Okay. Well, we'll get back to our conversation with Peter Lefcourt, and a little bit later we'll talk some more, encourage people to support the station. If you would like to call into this program now, the same number as always. Pledge will not be required. It'd be nice, but it's not required. That's 333-9455. That's for people here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have that toll-free line. For anybody who is outside of the immediate area here, that's 800-222-9455. And let me again introduce our guest, Peter Lefcourt. He's been a writer and producer of both film and television. He won an Emmy Award for the show, TV show Cagney and Lacey. In the late 80s, he started writing novels. His first was published in 1991, titled The Deal, and features this character, Charlie Burns, who also appears in his new novel, The Manhattan Beach Project. And his other books include 11 Karens, which, as he said, is sort of the story of a man and his relationship with 11 women, all named Karen, The Dreyfus Affair, The Deal, The Woody, Die and I, and Abbreviating Ernie. Those are his novels. And then he's also put together this anthology of pieces written by screenwriters who write about their first jobs. And that book is The First Time I Got Paid for It. If you're interested, you can go out and look for that. And questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm still sort of curious about the idea of the reality show. And I think when the which shows you why I'm not a big-time producer, I guess, when the first one, and I guess the first one that I would have been aware of was Survivor. That show came along, and I thought, well, this is never going to go anyplace. Even after the first season, I thought to myself, no, this is going to die out very quickly. But, of course, now every time you turn around, there is some sort of new reality program. What do you think accounts for the popularity of the genre? And then is this something that we're, like with other programs, we're going to see it, it's going to peak, and then it's going to be gone, and then there'll be something else, and then maybe sometime in the future it'll come back?
Well, this may sound a little extreme, David, but I think reality television is a little bit like crack cocaine. It's irresistible. It requires very little involvement on the part of the viewer. What bothers me about the genre isn't so much its simplicity and accessibility, is that it seems to feature the least desirable human characteristics. There's a lot of jealousy, envy, backstabbing, competition. Shows like Survivor or The Apprentice really seem to function on the basis of some of these very, very unattractive human qualities. And that's one of the problems I have with the show and that genre in general.
We have a caller to talk with. Why don't we do that on our line number one? Peter, you still there, Peter?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sorry. We just heard a noise on the line.
What happened? Yes, I had to switch phones, but I'm back.
Oh, okay. My director says to me, wait a minute, make sure he's still there. So we have a caller, someone calling on a cell phone in Urbana.
I hope it's not an attorney from one of the Karens.
Let's hope not. We'll see. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have a very brief question. There was a very big article in the New York Times recently about the lesbian theme in TV shows, and they refer to the girl, Willow, in Buffy and the Vampire, and the kiss between two women on Friends. Anyway, in that article, they said that that there was an undercurrent of lesbianism in Cagney and Lacey. And I just wanted to ask you, since you wrote for the show, was there, or was it an unintentional one, or did some of the writers want that in, or the producers? Is there anything, just because it had two women in the lead, obviously? In fact, I think right now in Desperate Housewives, because one of the leading actresses is 43 and not married, she's had to basically claim that she, or state that she wasn't a lesbian, because that was the rumor. And so anyways, the question is, did Cagney and Lacey, way back when, have an undercurrent theme of a lesbian relationship? And I'll just hang up and listen. Sorry if this is a crazy question.
Go ahead.
You could have fooled me. Certainly nothing that was consciously put in the show. I think there will always be those types of rumors, and whenever you have two attractive women, you know, who are working together, it's kind of a natural thing. But believe me, there certainly wasn't anything consciously put in the writing of the show, and certainly nothing between the two wonderful actresses, Tyne Daly and Sharon Gless. Yes, I've heard these before. I've heard the same stories about Desperate Housewives, and I'm sure that that's not true either. It's something that people see things on television, they tend to imagine things that really aren't there. And there certainly wasn't anything there in Cagney and Lacey.
All right. I think also I saw the piece that the caller was talking about, and it also seemed that the theme of the piece was that this is one of those things that gets pulled out at ratings times, at sweeps. And it is just one of those things that's done just to generate excitement, to generate titillation, whatever. It's kind of an exploitation deal. And at those points in the year where it's very important to the networks to get as many people watching as possible because there is a tie between the audience and their advertising revenue, that's why they do things at those times of year that they might not do the rest of the year.
You know, David, in my fictional reality show in the Manhattan Beach Project, Warlord, there's a real love affair between the daughter of the warlord and one of the camera women. They have a Polish crew filming it. And Charlie, the producer, actually uses this to help build the ratings. So actually, this is something that happens in television all the time. Anything that will help the ratings is something that is a desirable in a television show.
I'm shocked. I'm shocked to hear that such a thing would take place.
Mm-hmm.
Have you continued to be involved in writing television, or would you take that kind of opportunity if one was offered?
Absolutely. I actually had a very good experience a couple of years ago. I created and ran a show on Showtime called Beggars and Choosers, which was a satire on the television business, which was right up my alley. It was like shooting fish in a barrel. It was on for 2 years. We made 42 episodes about a man who was programming a network played by Brian Kerwin. And it was a delightful experience. It was on Showtime. We didn't have commercial breaks. We didn't have to worry about language. And the problem is that not that many people have Showtime, so it wasn't seen by that many people. But it may be coming out later on this year on DVD, which is the new reality of the television business. That was a wonderful experience. And I've continued to write pilots and movies for television, but less and less as the years go on, because I become more and more enamored of writing books. And as I get older, people are less excited about hiring me. Hmm. Again, one of the facts of life in the television business. I'm no longer 28. By a long shot.
You mentioned something I think it's interesting. Some people, I think, would make the argument that some of the most creative work in television is not going on network television, but it's going on places like Showtime or like HBO, where they have developed series that have been critical successes and popular successes. Although success in cable... It's defined differently because the potential audience is smaller than it is for the over-the-air broadcast network. And so you can count something as a success on HBO that might not seem so successful if it was on ABC because the numbers are much smaller. But and of course, on with a show like The Sopranos, for example, that runs on HBO, there are things that you can do that you cannot do
on over-the-air
television.
I think it's not just the lack of limits to artistic expression. It's the fact that cable television is not about broadcasting. Broadcasting is about reaching the largest possible audience, and so what you have to do essentially is write a little bit to the lowest common denominator. Cable television, you can do niche programming. You can write and produce programs that appeal to a smaller segment of the audience, as long as people keep buying subscriptions to the cable system. And HBO has done that brilliantly, and to a lesser extent, so has Showtime. But now you're seeing FX doing some very exciting things on television, and I think I would agree with you. I think some of the most creative work in television is being done on the cable systems, and it's being reflected in the number of Emmys that they're winning.
Hmm.
Every year you begin to see that HBO and Showtime and FX are winning a larger and larger percentage of the Emmy Awards by their peers.
So I was talking about this with a colleague the other day, and she was raising this question. Well, what is it that HBO, for example, is doing that's worked for them? It sounds like the answer that you would give is that, well, you're saying to yourself, we're going to create a show that it's not going to appeal to everyone, and that's going to be okay with us if it doesn't appeal to everyone, as long as it appeals to enough.
Yeah, they're also allowing writers and directors and actors to do just better and more honest work by not imposing limitations on them in terms of not just censorship of language, but also censorship of, to some extent, of ideas. That, you know, most conventional television is really written right down the middle of the page. There's always a fear that every single episode has to be resolved in a very neat and clean way. And you very rarely see kind of slightly different, more creative, slightly more original types of writing and acting and directing. And I think cable really is the move of the future. And we're hopeful that network television is beginning to move slightly in that direction. You mentioned Desperate Housewives, which is it's a soap opera, but it's a dark and funny soap opera. And I think people in the television business are encouraged that there has been some success for the show, because at least it's not another procedural drama. Television had been just absolutely drowning with procedural drama, CSI this, CSI that. In fact, in my book, I have two television programs, fictitious television programs. One is called CSI El Paso, and the other is called Law and Order ECD, or Ecclesiastical Crimes Division.
Let's talk with some other callers here. We got somebody over in Indiana on our line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. unfortunately, there's so many questions I'd like to ask a real writer that I just come up with something sort of maybe nebulous here. Do the Hollywood, I just have to say people, because I don't know who in the hell really runs things, you know, in terms of when a movie's actually made. Do they get into marketing research like Procter & Gamble do and things like that? Do they do focus groups? Then do they come to a writer, quote-unquote, and say, this is what we want? I guess the thing that bothers me is that you mentioned earlier about, you know, I write a story, then I see the movie, and I wonder what the hell happened in between the two, because that's not what I actually wrote. And that brings up an issue of, I would imagine, some sort of legal sense that, you know, you've pandered my novel. You've ruined it. You haven't done this or that. Does that ever get involved in the mix at all, those two things, the sort of research on what we're going to do, or is it just simply that movie made it last year and this is the movie we're going to run until it stops making money, then we'll...
Well, unfortunately, the Hollywood studios are parts now of major vertically integrated international, multinational companies, and they are terribly risk-averse. The average cost now of making a movie is about $80 million, and that does not count prints and advertising and releasing, so that they really are very wary of doing anything that's slightly original. The hope of the movie business are smaller independent films. A film like Sideways, for example, which is a film that was made on a very low budget, or My Big Fat Greek Wedding. Yes, and I think that's very much a fact. As a novelist, though, I must tell you, you just accept the fact that if Hollywood is going to make a movie out of your book, it's going to become a Hollywood movie. And most novelists that I know simply just take the money and write another book and don't worry about what Hollywood is going to do with it. Some writers adapt their own novels. I've done it a couple of times. And it's a little bit of a painful operation because you realize the book is just the basis of the movie. But I think most novelists accept it as just another form of income so that they can write more novels. Because I have to tell you, being a literary novelist is not a particularly lucrative profession. People are reading less and less, and it's harder and harder to make a living as a literary novelist.
There's one thing I want to make sure I understand, because I think this is the truth. If a studio comes along and they buy your book, or for that matter, if they buy a script that you have written, it's theirs.
Oh, absolutely.
You no longer have any claim to it.
They own the copyright. It's called work for hire. They do this so that you could get protection by the Writers Guild as an employee. But they own the copyright they don't own the copyright to the novel, obviously. As an adaptation, you own the novel. But they own the copyright to the movie from the novel, and they can do whatever they want with it. They can change the name, the title, anything they want. You sign over the rights to do that. Otherwise, there's no way they will buy it.
Mm-hmm. Just in response to the caller's other question, I know that, for example, what happens is that movies are made and then they're shown to, before they're released to the general audience, they're shown to sample audiences, and they ask the people who are watching the movie, well, what do you think? Did you like it? And certainly there are plenty of cases where things have been changed, endings of movies have been changed, because preview audiences said, oh, I don't like the way that story, I want it to end happily, I want it to end differently. Does it also happen that someone at a studio just has the idea that says, I want this kind of movie, I want these kinds of characters, I want these sorts of things to happen, and then they go to a writer and they have a, you know, it's like they have a checklist and say, all right, I want a script and I want it with this kind of setting and on these kind of characters, I want these kinds of things to happen, because they have some idea in their heads, that is the studio boss or whoever, that this is a movie that people want to see based on having gone out and asked people, what kind of movies do you want to see?
Yes, absolutely. Testing is a very real part of both the television and the movie business. In fact, in the Manhattan Beach Project, the Warlords reality show that they're making secretly in Uzbekistan is test marketed over a closed-circuit television system that ABCD runs. And this system is calibrated to find out just who are the demographics or the desirable audience. Television nowadays is all about getting people from age 18 to 35 to watch your television program. They're not particularly concerned about the people older than that because they believe that those people do not buy new brands. The advertisers are not interested in them. So the trick in television and to a lesser extent in movies is to be demographically desirable. Young people go to movies more than older people do. Young people buy different types of products more than older people do. Therefore, those are the people for whom television and movies are produced.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone here in Belgium that's nearby. Line number one. Hello.
Hello. I was just going to interject into the conversation. I thought that you were talking about niche markets and wanting to control your own product and everything like this. Well, WIL is very much on a cutting edge of things with their blogs and their internet aspects. What's to keep the future artist or person who generates this type of stuff to generate a website that produces his entire program himself? He writes it, he directs it, he acts in it, what does everything. Because rapid streaming and broadband could make that very much possible.
Well, I don't rapid stream, but I do have a website, which is www.peterlefcourt.com, and it's become kind of an occupational hazard for a novelist these days. And the website simply has a biography. It has the events in which I'm appearing. For example, right now I'm doing publicity on this book, so I'm doing signings and book touring. I put a couple of my short stories on it. There's a discussion link. There are links to buying my books. And it becomes part of the necessity of selling yourself. It used to be you'd write novels, and the publisher would go out and sell them. Now you write novels, and you have to go out and sell them also and get people to read them. And it's just part of the business of being a novelist. And perhaps someday I will be streaming my own novels over the website. I hope not, but that could happen.
No, sir, I think you're missing the point I'm saying. What I'm saying is you become the studio. You become the whole thing. Because there's so much, you know, programming. You can develop all kinds of things with all the programs they have for computers and stuff. And you would also sell this service. You would make money just somebody watching the play that you're putting on. It seems to me to be a very viable aspect of getting around some of these problems you have.
Well, it sounds very interesting, but movies cost millions and millions and millions of dollars. I still don't know how you would produce the types of quality film and television shows over a computer, no matter how advanced the technology becomes.
Well, I don't know. Pixar does some amazing things over a computer.
That's true, but Pixar is also a large company that has capital of millions and millions of dollars. I don't know how individual writers and artists, which I thought was your idea, would be able to produce their own work.
Well, you might have to be a little bit broader than just yourself, but you see what I'm saying.
Well, United Artists back in the 20s, Douglas Fairbanks, Charlie Chaplin, and Mary Astor did the exact same thing. They got together and started their own studio to try to control their product, and of course that was a great idea for a while, and it was taken over by the suits, which eventually happens. Most artists are not interested in business, and I think the answer to your question is that most artists would hire suits eventually to do the work that they don't want to do because they're interested in creating art and not in making business.
Well, I was referring to maybe just getting around some of the control of your content and telling who's going to do it and what you're going to do, and you just sell it more directly to the public yourself is essentially what I'm getting down to.
Stephen King does a little bit of that. Stephen King released a book over the Internet.
Yes, he has.
And he's done that type of thing. But most of us really just want to write books and make movies and are really not interested in that part of the marketing equation. But it's a good idea. I think it's a very interesting idea.
Thank you.
Thank you. If somebody wants to call real quick here, we can get him in before the time runs out. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Why Uzbekistan? Did you have some particular interest in Central Asia before the Manhattan Beach Project took shape?
You know, it's such a bizarre part of the world. You have this Islamic society that was colonialized by the Soviets and grafted onto the Muslim culture. You had social realism until about 1990. And when the Russians left, they left a vacuum. And it's just one of the most bizarre places on the planet. I did a great deal of reading and research about Central Asia. And it's a place that is, in fact, ruled by warlords to a great extent. And I just thought that was a great setting to do a reality television show because there is a lot of frontier kind of violence and action going on there. And that's exactly the type of thing that would appeal to a television audience. It's like Dodge City in 1880. Hmm.
Is there anything that you're working on now that you would feel like talking about? I know sometimes writers don't. You ask them, well, what are you writing now? They say, well, I really don't want to talk about it.
Actually, I'm conceptualizing. I'm gestating a novel about the Cannes Film Festival. I was there last May with my wife's film. She had a wonderful film based on a short story of mine called Recycling Flow. And we spent a week at Cannes, and it just struck me as a great setting to do a novel, because Cannes is really a business market masquerading as an art film festival. And I'm thinking of bringing Charlie Burns back one more time for the third book in the trilogy that would take place in the Cannes Film Festival. But, you know, that book is still in the gestation stages. I'm still really doing the work of going out and talking about this book, which is, as I said before, part of the work of a novelist.
Are there any film festivals that aren't like that anymore, that aren't actually business markets masquerading as the one thing I think about, I guess, is Sundance, which it sounds like that also now has become a business market masquerading as a film festival.
It started out, absolutely, as a haven for independent film. But I think that just is the way of all flesh, essentially, in the film business. You know, there are many, many, many small film festivals all over the world now. And the majority of them are, in fact, just film festivals. But they eventually, as they become more successful, they just attract people who are interested in buying and commercializing film. But I don't mean to be harsh about Cannes. Cannes is a wonderful place. It's interesting. It's a mixture of languages and culture. And there's a lot of very, very dynamic people there. It's just a great setting for a book, I think, and a great setting for someone to visit.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there because I'm sorry to say we have used the time that we have. If you would like to read a fun book, I would suggest you go out and get yourself a copy of The Manhattan Beach Project by our guest, Peter Lefcourt. The book is published by Simon & Schuster, and he has authored a number of other novels. He has also been a writer, producer of film and television, and won an Emmy for the show Cagney and Lacey. If you're interested in finding out more about him, you can look at his website, which is www.peterlefcourt.com. His last name spelled L-E-F-C-O-U-R-T. And Peter, thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure, David.